Hi, this is Ben Smith. I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening. Hey folks, this is Ben. You're listening to episode 91 of my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Many thanks for joining me and welcome along as always. My chat this week is with Martin Parr, who almost certainly needs no introduction, but who will get one anyway after a bit of housekeeping, a word from our sponsor, and an exciting bit of news. So please stay with it because there's a little bit to get through. If you do enjoy this podcast, you think it's worth the price of a cup of coffee and a Danish pastry per episode, then please do sign up for a small recurring monthly subscription, or if you prefer, make a larger occasional donation at bensmithphoto.com/a small voice. Do please subscribe on iTunes, even if you don't listen that way, it really helps to raise the podcast profile, and do leave a positive review there so that other photography fans may discover the podcast for themselves. If you're in need of a new website, WTF, it's 2018. Why? We have Squarespace, folks, so if you don't have the time or inclination to sort it out yourself, I will happily do it for you using the aforementioned Squarespace, who don't sponsor this podcast but should. I'll sort out everything. I'll even copy, edit, and correct your dodgy prose, all for a ridiculously competitive fee. Now, have you checked out the Charcoal Book Club's third annual Chico Hot Springs Portfolio Review and Charcoal Publishing Prize yet? Because you really should. This event, which will take place at the end of March 2019, is a juried photo book retreat happening over 6 nights at Chico Hot Springs Resort near Livingston in Montana. 45 photographers will be selected by the jury and invited to spend the week taking part in portfolio reviews, artist lectures, panel discussions, and getting together over drinks in the saloon and hanging out in the hot springs. It's open for entries now until the 10th of December, and you can submit now by going to charcoalbookclub.com and clicking on Portfolio Review in the top left corner. The panel of speakers and reviewers that will be there will include Todd Heido, Mark Steinmetz, Andrea Modica, Alex Webb, Rebecca Norris-Webb, Aperture, Pier 24 Photography, Chos Commune, TBW Books, and many others. So not only is this a rare chance to showcase your projects and workshop ideas with some of the best in the business, but one grand prize winner will receive the coveted Charcoal Publishing Prize, which means one lucky photographer will earn the right to be published and distributed worldwide by Charcoal Book Club. There will be a special Small Voice episode from the event because I will be there hanging out and having a great time, but you can be there too. Submit now by going to charcoalbookclub.com and click on Portfolio Review in the top left corner. And if you love photo books, join the Charcoal Book Club and use the code ASMALLVOICE to claim a previous book of the month of your choice, free when you do. So, to the man the Daily Telegraph declared to be arguably Britain's greatest living photographer, Martin Parr had a suburban childhood in the provincial county of Surrey in England, where his budding interest in the medium of photography was encouraged by his grandfather, George Parr, himself a keen amateur photographer. Martin went on to study photography at Manchester Polytechnic in the early 70s, and since that time has worked on many, many photographic projects, publishing over 100 books of his own work and editing another 30. Does that make you feel hopelessly unproductive? Yeah, thought so. He has developed an international reputation for his innovative imagery, his oblique approach to social documentary, and his input to photographic culture within the UK and abroad. In 1994, Martin became a full member of Magnum Photos, scraping in by a single vote in the face of strong opposition to his inclusion from some of the old guard, including Philip Jones Griffiths and Henri Cartier-Bresson himself. He's since become an important, influential Magnum member who served as president between 2013 and 2017. Martin has also developed an interest in filmmaking and has started to use his photography within different genres such as fashion and advertising. In 2002, the Barbican Art Gallery and the National Media Museum initiated a large retrospective for Martin's work, and his exhibition toured Europe for the next 5 years. Martin was Professor of Photography at the University of Wales Newport campus from 2004 to 2012 and Guest Artistic Director for the Isle Photo Festival in 2004. In 2006, he was awarded the Eric Solomon Prize and the resulting Assorted Cocktail Show opened at Photokina. And in 2008, he was Guest Curator at the New York Photo Festival. Parworld opened at Haus der Kunst Munich in 2008. This show exhibited Martin's own collection of objects, postcards, photography prints by both British and international photographers, photo books, and a new project from Martin himself entitled Luxury. The exhibition toured Europe for the following 2 years. At Photo España in 2008, Martin won the Baume & Mercier Award in recognition of his professional career and contributions to contemporary photography. He is co-author with Jerry Badger of the exhaustive three-volume series, The Photo Book, A History. And in March 2016, Strange and Familiar, curated by Martin, opened at the Barbican London, a show examining how international photographers from 1930s onwards have photographed in the UK. Martin was awarded the Sony World Photography Award for Outstanding Contribution to Photography in April 2017. And in autumn 2017, the Martin Parr Foundation, which is a gallery and archive dedicated to supporting and preserving the photographic legacy of not only Martin himself, but also of photographers who made and continue to make important work focused on the British Isles, opened in Bristol. Martin is currently working on an exhibition for the National Portrait Gallery, which opens in March 2019. So I got the train down to Bristol to the aforementioned Martin Parr Foundation, where I was warmly received by Martin's great young team of people tasked with taking care of the day-to-day running of the place, and as well as his own personal stuff. As he mentions, he's never processed a digital file in his life. And it's a great space and a great thing to happen to British photography, I think. I was shown into the inner sanctum, which is a veritable Aladdin's cave, went round opening drawers full of treasure, beautiful vintage prints by some of the greatest British photographers ever, had a flick through Martin's very organised archive of contact sheets, chock full of iconic images. Didn't even get started with the shelves of seminal photo books, really. I could have spent a week there, to be honest. You could lock me in, I'd be happy as Larry. But I had to make to do with a few hours, every minute of which was thoroughly enjoyable. One quick thing I want to mention before I bring you the chat with Martin. I'm delighted to report that the next three episodes of this podcast, starting next time, will be brought to you not only by the Charcot Book Club, but also by the Martin Parr Foundation. This all came about long after I'd had the chat with Martin, in case you conspiracy theorists start getting all excited. And the reason is that they want to let people know about the launch of the Foundation's new membership scheme, which begins in a couple of weeks, on November 12th to be precise. The aim of the membership is to open up access to the Foundation's library and archive collection, as well as giving discounts on their talks, screenings, workshops and bookshop. Membership contributions will help the Foundation keep entry to their gallery free, grow their archive collection and champion overlooked and emerging photographers. There are three tiers of membership, which start at £35 a year or just £25 if you're a student. So full details will be released on Monday the 12th of November. Through the Martin Parr Foundation's social media channels and their website at martinparrfoundation.org, or you can sign up to their newsletter. The Foundation's events have recently included speakers such as Sian Davey and Bruce Gilden, both previously of this parish, and Sir Don McCullen, to name just a few. And membership will include access to Martin's beautiful collection of over 2,000 photo books. The mid-tier membership comes with a signed 10x8 Martin Parr print, among other benefits, and is priced at £125, which is, you know, when you think about it, less than you'd normally pay just for a print alone. There'll also be a patrons level for those who want and can afford to support the Foundation's aims with a more substantial contribution. I suspect that won't be most of you. So anyway, sign up for that newsletter if you are interested in becoming a member, or if you just want to find out more about the membership scheme and you will be kept in the loop. At £35 a year, I think a membership it could be a very cool and decidedly affordable Christmas present for the photography lover in your life. I know that sounds like an ad. It's not an ad because the ads are next week, but I think that is basically why they want to let people know about it between now and Christmas, because it would actually make a very cool Christmas present. And the ads proper will start next episode. So here's the chat with Martin, which is preceded by a little photo book trivia quiz set for you by the man himself. As you will hear, I failed it dismally, much to Martin's evident dismay. Haven't felt like that since O-level French oral about 1,000 years ago. You may well do better than me. Don't cheat. And if you think Martin's wrong about any of the claims he makes, let us know in the comments section of the website. Without further ado, I bring you Mr. Martin Parr.
So here's the question for your listeners. What was the first independent photography book published by a British photographer, say, post-war? Well, not just post-war, but ever.
Don't know. Go on, tell me.
Oh, come on, Ben, have a guess.
So, like, in the 40s, British
photography. Well, you tell me. Was there independent photography in the 40s?
Well, how are we defining that?
You know, someone that's gone and done their own work as opposed to it being commissioned.
Chris Killip or someone like that?
No.
Or that would be too late, wouldn't it?
Come on, think on. Who was early British photographer? Like, very early.
Oh, man.
But independent.
I feel like I'm really on the spot. I feel like I'm failing an oral exam. Go on.
Okay, so here's Uppercase 5. This is a magazine published in 61. Right, so there's 5 issues of this Uppercase. It's a design magazine. But in Uppercase 5, there's a 56-page folio by Roger Main, okay, of his street kid pictures. So they took that and then made a small little book. So this Southern Street book here is, I would suggest, the first actual publication by an independent photographer.
Roger Main.
Yeah.
That's beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And when did you acquire that? Have you had that for ages?
I didn't know about it when we were doing even volume 3. It just came to light. You know, this is very rare, this.
I can imagine.
And I've talked to his daughter, who has confirmed that that is indeed the case.
That's incredible.
You can get Uppercase 5. You know, it's about £300 to £400. But this, I've never seen another copy for sale. She's got one. I've got one. I don't know of any others.
Wow. Well, it seems fitting that you've got one, or that the foundation has got one, I suppose we should say.
What was the first book, protest book, ever published in Britain? You don't know either, do you?
No.
Well, this is by David Hoffman, published in 73. And it's about the Myrtle Street eviction. He did an edition of 50.
And he signed your little thing.
And I've got the actual artwork for this book in the collection. So this is, I'd say, the first photographic protest book in Britain. Unless one of your listeners is going to tell me otherwise.
Well, you never know. But I defer to your expertise on it.
First book on drug culture in Britain.
Go on.
Ben, you haven't answered anything yet. You're meant to be an expert.
No, I'm not. I speak to people who know about these things. I'm learning.
Needle of Death, published in the early 70s.
An Addict's Day. No, an Addict's...
Heroin.
Yeah, Day. An Examination.
By a photographer that we don't know much about, called M.J. Delaney. Published... This is in Volume 3 of our history. Published in 67. Pretty good book, look.
Yeah. Actually, no, I have obviously got that book, your volume 3 and 2 and 3. I didn't get 1, but I got 2 and 3, and I did get that out the other day, but I didn't come across that yet. What else have you got that's of particular? What I love is that you're, you know, not only are you obviously a well-known photographer, you are a proper enthusiast, aren't you? You're a proper fan.
Yeah, of course.
But not all photographers are. I think there's a, you know, some
over
are
here, I'll show you something
mainly
nice.
Interested in their own work.
So this is the Tony Ray Jones ephemera box. And in here, these are early pictures by Ray Jones, by the way, that I acquired. But in here is, to my knowledge, the only time Ray Jones actually signed a book or a magazine which he had pictures in.
Oh, was he one of those people who didn't sign things?
No, he died before anything was published. This is the only thing, really. He did a Creative Camera magazine. He did an album, which, as you, I hope you know, is the 10-volume magazine that Bill Jay published.
Yes, I did know that.
Good.
Yeah, because he died quite young, didn't he? He was only in his 40s or something.
So this is to Anna, my dearest love, Tony. So that's a small little dedication. To my knowledge, it's entirely unique.
Do we know who Anna was?
His wife.
Okay, it was.
Yeah, Anna Ray Jones, who I'm also pretty friendly with.
Yeah.
So that I very much treasure.
I can imagine. Well, being a fan of his, you know, or being influenced by him and his work. So this is the collection that you're sort of in the process of I suppose, still collecting for the foundation itself.
Yeah, yeah.
And
we have, you know, we have ephemera from all these different photographers.
I've already had a little look at some of the incredible prints that you've got and also your own very well organised archive of contact sheets and negs.
So they're Killip things. So Did you know that Chris Killip did an Ian Dury's In the Blockhead LP cover?
No, I did not. I'm a big fan of Ian Dury and the Blockheads, but I don't think I've ever seen that one.
Chris Killip.
Yeah.
He didn't do many commercial jobs, actually, but this is one signed by him, look.
That's amazing. What's the album called?
So it's Ian Dury and the Blockheads.
Oh, Laughter. Yeah, I don't know Laughter. That's a fascinating thing.
Print. Press print. That's a Graham Smith Christmas card. Look at that. That's pretty nice.
That's beautiful.
This, of course, is a very influential Killip 1977 entire issue of Creative Camera. So I remember seeing this and being really excited. And here he's got Flash, and you see.
Creative Camera was quite an influential publication, was it?
Totally, yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Do you sort of sometimes forget what you've got? Because
I've pretty much got a good grip what I've got. Next, another copy of that.
This is all Killip stuff.
Harvard Photography Journal. Yeah.
I meant to ask you, of the big collection that the Tate acquired, what was the most valuable single book in the collection?
I'd say probably Joie de la Poupée by Hans Bellmer.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And what era is that from?
From the 30s or 40s.
Okay. What makes it so valuable? Just because it's rare?
It's hand-coloured prints by Bellmer, and it's one of, I think, 68 copies.
Wow. What do you reckon that was worth?
$100,000, one book.
Yeah, that's seriously good, isn't it? Fantastic.
Okay, that's your lesson for today, Ben. You didn't do very well.
Thank you. No, I failed dismally. I feel, I feel like I need to go and do some homework. This must be one of the most exciting things you've ever done, putting this place together.
I think so, yeah, because it's been a long-term ambition of mine to actually have this opportunity to give something back. And first, to look after my own archive, which means that my heirs don't have that issue, but also to collect and to show and to share the considerable achievements of British documentary photographers.
Yeah. So when did the idea first come to you, do you think?
About five, 6 years ago. And then I think legally we set up the charity about 4 years ago. And then last year, at the beginning of the year, I bought the building for the charity and then paid to have it done up. And now, of course, we opened in October. So we're just coming up to our first anniversary.
Mm, great. Okay. Yeah, because I was going to ask you about sort of how it was organised financially and all that kind of thing. And then I just realised that basically you just did it yourself, effectively. I mean, you bought the thing. But do you have, like, plans going forward, just to recoup the investment? Or, how's it all going to work in terms of the ideas that you can actually talk about? Maybe you've got a few things sort of under
well,
the hat.
I've arranged it so when I drop off this planet, it'll hopefully be sustainable. My considerable part of my estate will go to the foundation. In the meantime, we have a bookshop, we do talks, we do generate some income, we have a portrait session, but ultimately it's a loss-making thing. But I'm very lucky. I'm a well-paid photographer, so I can afford to reinvest this cash into the foundation. And I think we've been very pleased with our first year. Our talks are very well attended. Everything we do has a very positive response. So, and especially when the RPS open across the road, that'll mean that we're a bit of a Bristol hotspot for photography. So I think that'll be a considerable advantage as well.
Have any ideas come along that you didn't even have initially, that things that people have suggested might be, that you might be able to use the space for?
Not really. I mean, we're pretty much on target in terms of what we expected it to be used for. The only thing we have is an outside agreement with the University of West of England that their MA show is put on here in May or June. And for that, they give us quite a bit of sponsorship. So that's the only sort of commercial deal that we have so far.
Yeah. I'm wondering if whether this place may in some way help to change what you've described as a kind of strange attitude towards photography, what we have in the UK. I mean, what is that attitude, and what do you think is the reason for it? Can you just talk about that to some extent?
I guess it's very difficult for it to have the same respect and such like that it has in the rest of Europe and America. We're still quite ambivalent about photography in the UK. So although things are changing, especially since the Tate have got on board in terms of photography, the progress is slow. And I think in particular, documentary photography. So art photography thrives a lot better in the UK, in the environment there. You know, we've got Frieze this week. There'll be some art photographers showing there. But documentary photography, you probably won't see anything of that ilk in the whole of Frieze, even in Frieze Masters.
Why do you think we're like that here, though? I mean, you've talked about a sort of caution, a deep-rooted caution that we have. Is that the reason? I mean, in other countries, especially in other countries in Europe, sort of photography does seem to be respected as a medium more.
Yeah, I think there's a sort of deep-rooted reluctance to sort of accept that photography is an art form in its own right. I mean, there's we're a country that loves words and music and theatre. And writing and all these things have great respect, but photography still isn't respected that much. So, for example, if I do a show in London, it's very rare that I would get a review in any serious paper. Well, if I do a show in Paris, every newspaper, Libération, Le Monde, will all review it automatically.
What have you got coming up that you're kind of looking forward to then, excited about, events or shows that are planned?
Well, we've got Don McCullin coming, which is a real coup. We sold that out almost instantly, and he very rarely now does any talk. So I know Don pretty well, so I was able to basically twist his finger.
Right.
And, we've got an exciting program of exhibitions. I mean, I'm almost overwhelmed with things I want to show and want to share. So delighted now that Paul Trevor is on, very underrated British documentary photographer.
Right.
So bring them on. You know, we're going to have we've got a full program already for next year. I think it's an exciting time.
That's fantastic. Well, in terms of your own work, I'd like to just sort of go through, to some extent, let's gallop through your career, as it were, for some of the younger listeners who won't necessarily be fully familiar with everything you've done. You sort of described yourself as a home counties kid. You grew up in suburbia. Do you think that had a big impact on the kind of photographer you ended up being?
I think the blandness of Surrey that I was brought up around made it that when I went to visit my grandfather in Yorkshire, I was really taken with the sense of community, the sense of friendliness. And of course, he was an amateur photographer, so it was he that really got me excited about photography in the first place. But I think the contrast between suburban Surrey and the north had a great impact on me. And ultimately, I ended up living in Hebden Bridge, and always try to catch up with my lost childhood by photographing there in the 70s. So yes, I think I was very smitten with the friendliness of the north and a sense of community that you don't get in Surrey.
Right, right. But the kind of banality of the suburbs is more the kind of thing that became an inspiration later on in your photography, I would imagine, at least.
Yes, I guess to a certain extent. I mean, I did photograph in suburban Surrey. I've got some pictures from that. And I suppose that sort of blandness of that life, has had an impact. I'm always fascinated by everyday life and trying to find the ordinary or extraordinary within that. We often, because we're surrounded by things, are pretty complacent about what our surroundings are like. So that's one of the strategies I've pursued.
Well, the stuff in Hebden Bridge was very different to what you ended up kind of moving into. For a start, it was black and white. You're very much known for colour now. It was, I guess, I might describe it as a sort of almost classical magnum style of documentary, you know, beautifully composed and that kind of thing. But what drew you to that community? What did you enjoy about it? And was it a good time? Was it a good time to be shooting in that stage in your life?
No, the 5 years in Hebden Bridge were not only very productive, but a great, very, very good experience. It was before Hebden Bridge became more like a tourist location, so there's still factories there. The old-fashioned working-class community was still in existence. But the thing I really honed in on was the nonconformist chapels, because they sort of summed up this sense of community that I was really chasing. And also, I come from a Methodist background, so it seemed very appropriate for me to explore that, which I did quite thoroughly. And in particular, Grimsworth Dean Methodist Chapel, a small one about 5 miles away from Hebden Bridge. And we got to know every farmer there. We went to visit their farms. We would go quite often to the sun. We would go nearly every Sunday to the service there. So we got to know it very well.
I think you've mentioned, you know, some of your early influences many times in the past, but I know that Tony Ray Jones was one. Can you talk about Tony a little bit in terms of what you liked about his work?
I guess I was really taken with Tony Dre Jones when he was introduced to us as a Manchester Polytechnic student, when Bill Jay, the then editor of Creative Camera, came through and gave a talk about British photographers, and in particular Tony Dre Jones, and no one had seen it him before, so we were smitten immediately. And I guess, you know, he'd been to America, he'd learnt the trade of that generation of photographers from the 60s. He hung out with people like Winogrand and Frank and such like, and he brought that spatial awareness and applied it to the UK, and that was probably the first time that combination occurred, and that was the thing that was so engaging and so exciting for me.
Mm. You fairly quickly moved into a very different style, I suppose you could say. I guess The Last Resort was your first colour project, is that true? And that's the book that a lot of people will know you for. It was pictures of the beach, the seaside in New Brighton, Liverpool. I'm just wondering about how that style developed, that, you know, the distinctive style that people know you for, with the saturated colour and the flash. I mean, was it partly a function of just having to shoot in bright sunlight and that kind of thing, or you know, was it something that just evolved, or did you actually think and consider it?
I mean, I was aware of the effect that flash had in photographs, and even with colour, I'd seen people like Andy Earle, who had shot pictures in places like Ascot using colour. And of course, I'd seen the serious colour photography coming from the States, you know, people like Eggleston and Shaw. And in particular, in the UK, we had people like Peter Mitchell with his very important show in 79 at the Impressions Gallery, A New Refutation of Viking 4. And I think it's all those things combined that really made me think it's time to explore colour. And it was just at the time they'd introduced this new Plowboy camera. So this gave me the chance to move up from 35mm to 6x7. And inevitably, I just used flash as well.
Mm.
You're right insofar that it killed any shadows in daylight. And it was a very good thing to use and apply.
And you talk about you kind of got a love for shooting in the British seaside, and you've talked about how it's sort of slightly sad and depressing, or decaying, I think was the word. But what is it you like about that?
Well, first off, I wasn't really taken to the seaside when I was a kid, because we went on birdwatching trips. So if we went, we'd go to places like Pagham Harbour, but we didn't go to the glitzy beach. So that was always an appeal for me. And I just like the energy of the seaside. I like the kitschiness, the drive of it, everything about it really appealed. So I've always been hooked onto seaside resorts, and throughout my career, I've applied different techniques and ideas to solving that issue of how do you take a picture on a beach.
I suppose one of the attractions is there's no lack of subject matter, is there, at the beach? And there's always something to shoot if you look carefully enough.
And not only in the UK, but all around the world. You know, I've been to, Rio. I've been to Mar del Plata in Argentina. I've been to Indian beaches. I can't get enough, basically.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think in a way it was kind of a quite a political project, I think, because in a way it was a response to Thatcherism. Was it consciously so?
Yeah, I mean, it was during the time of Thatcher, and I think New Brighton in particular, you know, Liverpool was quite run down, and I like the idea, though, that people still had the day out at New Brighton with the kids, with the family. So you have this backdrop, which is quite shabby, and this domestic activity in front of it. So that appealed to me as being a sort of little contrast with the ability to show those two together, slightly at odds with each other.
Yeah. I mean, you talk about how that your kind of priority is to take an entertaining picture and then to sort of almost sneak the message in, you know, underneath. Do you remember that being some kind of a conscious decision, or was that just the natural way that you started working?
And as you mentioned, my priority is to make an interesting, entertaining picture. And then behind that all, there can be a serious message. But, you know, I'm not one of these photographers, many of whom you photograph, that say, you know, my job is to change the world or to change opinion. I'm just showing it as I see it. And I'm very happy if anyone pays attention.
There was a lot of pushback from some quarters of that project, that you were accused of being being cynical or exploiting the working classes or something. You know, did that sort of criticism take you by surprise, or did you anticipate it in any way?
I sort of half expected it to come, and when it came, I realised that it wasn't a bad thing. So, the show was first shown in Liverpool, and everyone knows in Liverpool what New Brighton is like, so it wasn't really an issue.
But when it went to the Serpentine in London, that's when this sort of response really started. And pretty soon on, I decided just to embrace it and go with it, because it's better to be controversial than to have no one responding to your work whatsoever.
Right, okay, yeah. So all publicity is good publicity in a way. But is there an element of truth in that that charge, that you're in some way cynical?
I don't think so, but, you know, it's not up to me to say. But, you know, I really enjoy photographing people. I like people. So I don't think it is cynical. I mean, there's a sense of mischief there, because you have to be to get your point across.
Yeah.
But cynical is not the word I would apply. But, you know, I'm not going to stop anyone, you know, using that. I've had worse than that applied, like fascist and such like, by my Magnum colleague, Philip Jones Griffiths. But that's his prerogative, of course.
Can you expand on what it was, what bothered him particularly? Because I know that when you actually joined Magnum, you know, he was very resistant, like, presumably for that reason. But
well, you'd have to ask him.
Yeah.
But sadly, he's
no longer with us.
Thank you, yeah.
Yeah.
It's not up to me to say
no.
And give you a description of why someone dislikes me.
No, fair enough. Absolutely, that's true. And I'm just trying to sort of figure out what it is that in a way, it seems like, you know, one is not allowed to show a sort of unvarnished portrayal of the working classes. It sort of seems to be very romanticized for some reason, whereas if you portray rich people in that way, no one's bothered. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, there's an element of truth in that. It's much easier to apply that to wealthy people, and you're right, it's going to not get the same response as it would do with working class. But yeah, I'm very democratic when I've come to classes. I've photographed every class.
Right.
Especially in the UK,
yeah,
from the establishment through right down to the working class,
yeah,
middle classes, upper classes, the lot. You know, they're all a great subject matter for me.
They all have their own fascination in themselves for you. Yeah, I mean, you talk about having a sort of love-hate relationship with the UK. Can you give me a couple of things you love and a couple of things you hate, just to give a sort of flavour of where you stand on all that?
I mean, I you know, there's nothing better for me than being out on a Saturday afternoon, say, at a church fete in Dorset or something like that, you know. But at the same time, those very people might be the people that have, you know, voted to leave the EU, and that sort of bigotry and that inherent racism that you often see in this country very much annoy me. So the whole point about photographing around the UK is to, you know, exorcise these sort of feelings, and it is partly therapeutic, therefore. And I'm able to hopefully encompass both sides of the argument into pictures, into imagery.
Well, you've raised the topic of Brexit, so we ought to talk about it to some extent, because it seems like it's a very Martin Parr subject, right? I mean, it's sort of much as I'm sure you'd rather we didn't have it, as most of us probably would agree. How are you responding to it photographically?
Well, in the show that I'm doing next March at the National Portrait Gallery, the biggest room will be Britain in a Time of Brexit, which will have pictures from the last few years, and it'll have St. George's marches, Cornish fishermen, various subjects that have been associated with Brexit. And I guess this is just an offering that I'm making, you know, because it's very much to do with this exhibition about national identity. It's in the month that we're meant to be leaving, so hopefully it'll mean it has some poignancy in terms of the timing, if nothing else.
Absolutely, yeah. And so you've been travelling around the country to some extent. Have you gained any insight by talking to people and sort of, you know, engaging with people as to the kind of fundamentals of why people voted that way?
Not real insight. I mean, you know, when we spoke to Cornish fishermen, we were surprised that they weren't all raving Brexiteers, but not really. I don't think anything much has changed. You just know where the hotspots are. You know that places like Lincolnshire and Cornwall are very extreme voting in terms of Brexit. And they're some of the places I've been back to, especially to photograph them. So I went to Lincolnshire and I've been down to Cornwall. So that's sort of quite interesting, really. So I've made that my job to try and encompass those areas that did have a high voting Brexit constituency.
Well, maybe the better question is, you know, what do people who voted to leave think is going to come from that decision?
I really don't know. I mean, as we all know, you know, this the whole promise of the bonus that would be going to the NHS has proven to be inaccurate, and that we're now saying it's costing us $500 million a week to pay for the Brexit clause. So yeah. Who knows? I'm no expert.
Right, fair enough. Well, I don't think anyone is. Let's talk about photo books a little bit because, you know, I think one has to talk about photo books to you. You got rid of your...
got rid of is the wrong
it's
word.
It's a terrible way to say it, isn't it?
I sold it at a very good price to the Tate. You know, it was 12,000 books. It's a very good collection.
Yeah.
It's too much responsibility to look after.
Mm.
People were loaning books to me all the time, and it wasn't insured. So I took this opportunity to basically pass it on to the Tate. And that income, of course, has helped me set up the foundation. And since then, I've bought, this is to the left, Chris Killip's old collection, or 60% of it. And the ones behind and in front of you are the British collection, wow. Many of which came from the Killip thing, many of which were duplicates that I had, and the rest I've gone out and bought again.
Right, okay. So you find yourself in a position of actually rebuying books that you already had. Wouldn't it have been easier to just keep the ones that you...
No, but the whole point of the Tate thing is it has to be a complete collection.
Ah.
They can't cherry pick.
I see, yeah, yeah.
And I wouldn't even want them to cherry pick, you know, because the British collection is a very important part of that.
Mm. So it's kind of easier to just start again, as it were, and just...
Yeah.
But I mean, I'm intrigued at how does one even begin to sort of value a collection like that? Like, you know, did someone literally get a calculator out and go, well, this is 12,000 books times an average of whatever?
No, we got, you know, someone came in first to value it for them, and someone came in to value it for myself. So those two figures were sort of put onto the table, and then we worked out a good compromise.
All right, okay. So,
yes, it was professionally valued. It didn't have to be.
Yeah.
Because the other thing about it was there was no actual inventory. You know, they could see what was there, but it wasn't actually written down. I hadn't got around to making inventory of the 13,000 books. I got up to 1,000, and then it was overwhelming.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Especially with all the languages, there's Chinese, there's Japanese, you know, all these different European languages, Spanish from Latin America. It was, you know, it's a huge task. So now the Tate are doing that, and they've got two people on that full time in their warehouse in South London where it's arrived.
Wow. And do you ever sort of stare longingly at your empty shelves and wish that you still had the books there?
No, I was fully aware that, you know, it was a great part of my life. And, you know, it's not as if I'm not surrounded by books. You know, most of the great photo books Killip had in his collection. And he was retiring from Harvard, so I was able to buy that from him. And, you know, since then, you know, I can go to Paris Photo without getting into a fluster about missing the great new books coming from Europe. Although I have helped the Tate, you know, select some of the books that they're continuing to buy to add to the collection.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, inevitably, I think I should ask you which ones are your sort of absolute kind of ultimate faves. If you had to save a couple from the fire, as it were, what would you go with if you had to pick, you know, two or three?
I mean, the first photo book I bought was The Americans by Robert Frank, so that would be high on the list. And then there's the new discoveries like Bye Bye Photography by Dido, which is something I only came across in the 80s. And when I discovered the strength of those Japanese books from that provoked period, you know, it was a real mind-blowing experience because at that point in time, they hadn't really been recognized. Everyone knows now the achievements of that generation of Japanese photographers. But, you know, back in the day, they hadn't really sort of twigged that.
Mm-hmm. What about stuff that you've discovered in very recent years, which, you know, you're particularly taken with it? Can you think of any in particular?
Well, I suppose the books that I found from Iran. Iran is one of those countries that I was aware had a photographic book history, and I suddenly had an opportunity to buy a collection that had come from there, and they are wonderful books. So they're something that I hadn't really seen before. They immediately went to the Tate. And they've already displayed them, in fact, because they're pretty rare and they're very interesting.
Mm.
So that's a real little gem that I came across only in recent years. So in fact, even in volume 3, which is the last one Jerry and I published, we didn't put in the Iranian books because we hadn't got them at that point in time. So we could go on and do volume 4, etc. But
right.
I feel now's the time to get out and let someone else take over.
Yeah.
Or let other people take the movement forward.
Well, this is your series. You did History of the Photo Book, which, as you say, was a three-volume series, and not everyone will necessarily be aware of it. But I'll put links to all these things that you're mentioning in the show notes so people can check out these photographers, because these references are going to come thick and fast with you. I know that, and they know that's going to happen. And people will, of course, be curious as to what you're talking about or who you're talking about. apart from the quality of the individual images themselves, what factors separate an exceptional photo book from the rest, would you say?
Well, it's got to have, it's got to have something, a great story at the core of it, and it's got to be well designed to echo what's going on in those images, and it's got to have the correct sequence. But ultimately, it's about the power of those individual pictures. And the thing with photography, it's so easy to do and yet so difficult to actually do. And that's the thing that confounds people. And many of the books that we see now published aren't really resolved. There is nothing particularly fresh or new added in. So you can tell pretty immediately by looking at a book or indeed a body of work how much effort has been invested in that. And I'm looking for people that really have put themselves out. That's the general quality that I'm looking out for more than anything else, in fact. And the fact that they got something to say through those images and their connection to the world out there.
I see. Okay, yeah. Well, because I was going to say, what do the people who don't get it right fail to do? But you've sort of just answered that question in a way. They don't perhaps consider those things carefully.
Well,
enough.
People are lazy, basically. Photography can make you lazy. Mm. There are no shortcuts in photography. You know, you have to invest that passion, that investment, that time, that concern, if you want to get decent work.
Which of your own books are you sort of most satisfied with, or proud of in terms of it being a kind of very complete project or,
Well, I guess The Last Resort continues to sell pretty well. It's, so ultimately when I go to the pearly gates, that's the one I'm going to get out first.
Right, yeah.
Given that I've done over 100 books, I'm not going to tell you that all of them are great, They've all got, many of them have got things going in their favour. But, they're not all going to be great books. There's no question about that.
I mean, having done so many, you've done so many more than certainly anyone else I've ever spoken to. For someone who is about to try and put their first one together, what would be your top tip for, getting
it
right?
Well, does it work? I mean, the danger is they'll publish it too early.
Right.
And it'll just be like another also-ran and won't really register.
Right.
It may not be good enough. It's as simple as that.
And how does one
Well, you have to go to Foley reviews, have to get response,
get other people's view.
You have to go to the tastemakers. Right. Don't just show it to your mum or your girlfriend.
No, because they'll just like it automatically, immediately. Yeah. I want to ask you about Magnum a little bit, because of course, you've been in Magnum a long time and you were president quite until relatively recently. Is that the job that no one really wants, or did you get anything out of that? Did you learn anything from the process of doing that?
I guess it's one of those jobs that there are very few photographers in Magnum who are able to be president. And I felt, ultimately I had a responsibility to take my turn. And, one of the first things I did was to help find a new CEO, who is this guy called David Cogan, who's turned out to be pretty good news for us, because he's really made us much more business savvy. He's turned the business into a much more meaningful structure. So I think the income's gone up, and we've now introduced the whole digital era into Magnum, so we're as much a business to consumer organization as just selling business to business, which is what we were before. So I think Magnum's in better health now than it was 5 years ago, just before I became president.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about how you feel about its chances of surviving and thriving now, because there have been some quite major changes. They've taken in some outside investment, the sort of complexities of which I personally don't really quite understand. But does that sit comfortably with you, that's sort of the kind of monetization, the need to think commercially?
No, we had to get investment because to update our software systems and to basically get our site running on a professional basis, to get the accounting systems running. We had to do that with money. So we created a new trading company separate to Magnum, which is what the new people have invested in, which is capped to a percentage. So they can never go beyond that. And the old Magnum still makes all the decisions about, the moral decisions, who joins Magnum. So we haven't sort of eroded that ultimate sort of sense of responsibility that we have over ourselves. But we've invested in this new trading company, which will basically mean that we can operate in a more meaningful way than we were able to before.
Right, okay. Was joining a big boost for your career, do you think?
I guess it helped enormously get my work out beyond the sort of immediate surroundings. That's the thing that Magnum can do very well.
Mm.
So in that sense, yes, it was a huge thing. I mean, I would have survived without Magnum.
Yeah, of course.
But it's been my ability to license images, to get commissions, that's been introduced and heightened very much by Magnum's involvement.
Mm. Well, we've already talked to some extent about this sort of pushback that you had from some of the old guard, Philip Jones Griffiths in particular, and Henri Cartier-Bresson himself suggested you were an alien or something. Did that hurt?
No, I quite enjoyed it. I mean, obviously, Philip's scathing write-up, which is published now in the Magnum Manifesto book. Uh-huh. I don't know if you've seen that.
Yeah, I have. I own it. But I haven't read it for a while.
Right. So that was quite scathing. But, I guess the interlude with Bresson was not only quite entertaining, but, there's an element of truth there. You know, I am from another planet from him. But after that, Martine Frank was very keen that we sort of... waved the white flag, so she got me round to Rue de Rivoli. So, we became friends again after that.
Oh, that's good.
But in fact, again, like all the controversies I've had, it does you no harm.
No.
Even Philip's scathing and contemptible view of me, I sort of almost, I almost thank him for doing that.
Right, yeah. Well, you're obviously very thick-skinned, and, I guess you have your own sense of yourself. You don't really care too much what other people think about you, which I guess is a very useful trait to have if you're going to be producing work. But the Cartier-Bresson thing is more like, I don't really know what he was getting at. Was it just that he, your style of working was so different to what he expected, or you don't really know?
Again, I mean, yeah. It's not up to me to tell you.
No.
Sadly, you can't ask him either.
No. Well, it just surprised me because these are guys who, in a way, invented their own genre. They created this thing, and then to then not be receptive to someone then moving it along, it seems incongruous to me that they wouldn't be embracing of that in a way.
Can't argue with that.
I've been thinking about, actually, on the subject of Magnum, I went to the whiskey thing recently. You did a collaboration with one of the distilleries in Scotland.
Yes.
And I was just wondering about whether that sort of that kind of corporate collaboration that is now become, a way of, I guess, generating income. Is there going to be more of that kind of thing? And did you see that as a pretty successful sort of, attempt at, maintaining some kind of creative credibility, but also kind of ticking their boxes? Because you produced what was a really impressive tome of a book. And as a result of kind of documenting the construction of a new distillery that basically had, I can't remember which.
McAllen,
yeah. Could you sort of talk a little bit about
that? I mean, this has always been an integral part of Magnum's work, because back in the 50s, 60s, everyone was doing company reports. Company reports don't really exist now, so we don't do them. So instead, we do campaigns like the McAllen one. So it's just a shift in terms of how it's done. But it's absolutely integral to who we are. We can earn very good money with this, which we can all reinvest in terms of our own work, and likewise for Magnum, gives them a chance to sort of, break even and become, a solvent, sustainable organization.
Mm-hmm. Well, I thought what was interesting about it is that they gave you the time, and obviously that there was a time frame inherent because it was about the building of this place, and that's going to take a certain amount of time. But I thought, it was noticeable that the amount of time that you all had, because there were a number of you involved in the project, meant that the pictures were actually, good, I think, rather than, something that had been knocked off kind of thing.
No, I think they really, believed in us, and they gave us as much time as we needed to photograph there. I mean, Mark Power, who soon used up his quota, was then re-employed to come on and to continue to document the building of this remarkable new distillery over and above what he'd already was already consigned to him.
Mm.
So it just shows you they are able to sort of accommodate that extra work if need be.
Yeah, yeah. Mark's been on the podcast in the past, so he's one of the people I've spoken to. It's kind of ironic that you shoot people at leisure, because in terms of your own leisure, you must be the busiest man in the world. Like, do you have a knack for time management?
I guess I get up early and I work pretty hard. But, when I'm out photographing, it's my hobby. So I have a lot of leisure time. Right. Most of the time when I'm photographing is, as far as I'm concerned, leisure time.
Yeah. But how does it work now when you've got these other commitments? Are you still, do you have to sort of remind yourself to go and shoot, or is that always the priority?
No, I'll always incorporate shooting for myself into my timetable, and then everything else fits in around that, really. So there'll be certain projects that I'll do. Tomorrow I'm going to London. I'm going to be photographing Frieze. That's something that Magnum are going to use, so they'll pay my expenses and get me the accreditation. And I'm always very happy to go to events like that. There's always going to be photographs to be taken.
Mm. Do you still get the same kick out of actually doing the work, and you have still the same passion for it?
Oh, definitely, yeah. I mean, I just love being out there with a camera and just seeing the subject in front of me and thinking, how on earth can I, you know, transfer any of the energy I see out there into the camera?
Yeah, yeah. And now you're digital now, so you don't have to wait for processing and contact sheets. You can see immediately what you're getting.
You can. But in fact, I mean, the great thing is I've got people here that do all the processing for me. So I've never processed a file in my life.
Right.
It gives me more time to go out and take pictures.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, obviously, I suppose in the course of a long career, your enthusiasm is going to ebb and flow naturally. I mean, by definition. So do you have to, you know, kind of work at maintaining that level of enthusiasm, or is it just, does it come fairly naturally to you?
Pretty natural, really. Yeah. I mean, my problem is there's so many things I'd like to photograph, I never have the time to do it. And of course, you have other things you have to do, you know, like admin and organizing this and talking to people like you.
Yeah.
You know, there are distractions constantly coming at me, but you know, I still find the time to go and do it.
That sort of puts me in mind of, I had a few questions from listeners which I you know, elicited, which I might run a few by you.
Okay.
But that has put me in mind of one, which was, is there any section of British society that you've always wanted to photograph but have not yet had the chance to?
I've never been to the Queen's garden party because they won't let photographers in.
No.
So that's just one event that I'd love to photograph, but I can't. And I couldn't get into Eton, actually. I mean, I photographed in Harrow, Christ Hospital, Bristol Grammar, but Eton kept saying no.
Right,
so must have been worried.
So certain institutions that you'd like to get your wrangle your way into, just proving impossible. But what about more in terms of sort of sub-genres of, you know, of society or certain groups? Are there any things, you know, anything you've had in mind for a while that you've thought one of these days I'm going to actually do?
Yeah,
that?
Because most of the things like that I've wanted to do, I've gone and
you've
done.
You've just done them?
Yeah, because if I want to go anywhere, or go or do anything, I'll just do it.
Right. Well, that might be the key to your productivity, you know, because I think a lot of us find ways to talk ourselves out of doing things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's all too easy, isn't it, to find all the reasons why it's, you know, you shouldn't go and do that. Do you find time to look at other people's projects? I presume you get, you know, inundated with stuff to look at, but is that part of your role as you see?
Oh, sure, because you know I've done quite a bit of curating, so you know, being a curator, you've got to be aware of what's going on. So of course I travel a lot, so as you travel you go and look at bookshops, you talk to other photographers, they'll tell you what's happening, you know, to places like Paris Photo, and you can see a lot of new work there. So I'm always on the lookout for interesting new work.
And people, even stuff that hasn't been published or seen anywhere, like if someone just, you know, sends you.
Well, I can't look at everything that people send
me.
No,
of course not.
Because I get a bit inundated and people want to come and meet me, and it's really difficult just to find the time. But, you know, I'm constantly looking out for things that might be interesting.
Who are the contemporary British photographers that you're particularly kind of fond of at the moment? Can you think of a couple of
Well, we
people?
Just had Simon Roberts here 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
You know, you mentioned Mark Power.
Yeah, Simon's been on the podcast.
There you go,
You had Neil McDermott, who's
yes,
also been
Neil
on the podcast.
Yes, Neil was a very good photographer, so we gave him a very nice show, which did very well for him.
Yeah.
And we fixed up a publisher, RRB, here in Bristol. And then the other people like Chloe Dye Matthews, I'm a big fan of.
Chloe's done it.
Clementine Schneiderman, next year we're showing, who's a French photographer that lives in Wales. She's been working in the Valleys in Wales with a stylist, so she's got this sort of imagery which is on the cusp of you know, fashion and portraits. That's good. So yeah, we have a busy program.
I thought you'd be a good person to ask, how does one be kind of influenced by and inspired by other people's work, but at the same time not just replicate it? How does one find their own voice for themselves?
Well, you have to learn from what other people have achieved, and learn from the history of photography, and then take on board the lessons that you can read and apply them to your own voice, if you like. You know, what we've got to do, all of us, is find our own particular voice. Many people will not succeed to do that. And you do that when you find the right subject and you find the right relationship to the subject, and your enthusiasm and passion overtakes you. So you need, if you like, to you know, steal from other people, then make it your own.
Mm.
That's easier said than done, of course. And most people do not do that. They end up really just copying other stylistic approaches that have been before.
Mm-hmm. What other advice do you find yourself sort of repeatedly giving to young photographers, or what kind of, you know, advice are they looking for?
Well, they're generally a bit lazy. They generally don't work hard enough. They generally try to get a book published before it's even ready because they haven't really resolved the thing that's unique to that body of work. That's the danger of photography. It looks very easy to produce work that, you know, may look good on one level but hasn't got the soul that really it needs to have to make it work.
Mm. Well, I was going to ask you about, you know, talking about the strength of the individual image, but if you do a body of work, a photo book, for instance, you know, is there a sense in which the individual images don't matter as much as the sort of as the whole, in the sense that, you know, some work can be really quite banal in a way, but that still seems to get quite celebrated when it's put together collectively as a project.
No, I think that's a very good... I mean, John Myers is a good example. He's someone I've always liked. You could say his arguments are pretty bland, really.
Yeah.
But when you see them all together, it really works. And you can see that he had a very strong personality, and it comes through. And you need that body of work, as published recently in his book, to understand that.
Yeah, the whole can be greater than the sum of its parts, basically. Well, what do you think is your greatest strength as a photographer?
Basically just continuing.
Yeah, keep
survival.
Going. Right. Longevity.
Yes.
Yeah. And your main weakness, as you would see it, what do you think is that?
I mean, I'm not a poet in the way that, you know, some photographers are just naturally poetic, like Sergio Laran or Frank. You know, I haven't quite got that ability, but, you know, I can appreciate other people when they do. You know, I think I've got enough going to keep me going, but I can see the weaknesses of what I do. And I guess, you know, I don't want to talk about the strengths because that's not what one does.
No. If you went back to your sort of young self, that you know, having just sort of finished at Manchester Polytechnic or whatever, what advice would you give to that guy?
Well, keep going. Find the right subject matter and, you know, make it work.
Mm. Well, you did that anyway, so that's...
I guess, yeah.
Yeah. And coming forward a bit, like, you know, if you think about your sort of mid-30s or something, what advice would you have for that guy?
I don't know, really. I mean, by the mid-30s, you know, I'd changed the colour, I'd got the last resort. So I had really, it's not that I didn't have a voice in black and white, but it's less distinctive. You know, the colour really helped me to get noticed, particularly beyond the UK. You know, it's really when my first international career started out. And, you know, then I became part of that whole movement in the 80s of British documentary in colour. So that was a good thing to be part of.
Mm.
And the rest just keeps going, really.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So who were the other guys in that little group that you'd identify?
Well, I talked about Peter Mitchell, but of course Paul Graham was the other
main
person. And he did that wonderful trilogy of books in the 80s, which is, you know, a remarkable achievement, all self-published and all very good. And they still look very good to this very day.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he's someone I'd like to get hold of at some point in the future. There's a question I always like to ask, which is about, and there's not normally people of your stature get asked this, but the kind of income pie chart. In other words, the idea that one has numerous different revenue streams and that makes up your entire. I'm not asking you about numbers, but what, like, you know, are the slices all kind of roughly the same size, or is there something that kind of tends to bring in more than the other things?
I guess it's a combination of the commission work and print sales. They're the two main components.
Mm.
And, of course, the licensing through Magnum.
Mm.
Editorials hardly significant.
Anything, yeah.
Publishing, you know, is small but important. Many of the books I do, there's no income whatsoever, but with when you get work with people like Fiden, you do get royalties, and they just sort of keep trucking over, really.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'd say those two things, the commissioning and the print sales, are the biggest component.
Mm. What do you think the best thing that you've ever done for your career has been then? Apart from joining Magnum, obviously, which we've already sort of discussed.
Well, I guess starting the foundation, of course.
Yeah.
And like I say, just keeping at it.
Yeah, right. Can you think about anything that you were completely wrong about?
I remember once criticising Tom Wood, a very good friend of mine, for combining black and white and colour in a book. And he's always harangued me about that. And of course, I realised now that that was a big mistake to have ever come up with.
There are still people who have an aversion to that, to doing that, I must say. I guess that's sort of become a bit of a thing. But you haven't got any issue with that anymore?
No, not at all. I'm very relaxed now, yeah. Okay. I'm just editing a book with Tom about some of his greatest pictures from Liverpool.
Oh, great. When's that going to come out?
I'm not sure yet.
Oh, great. I'd love to get him on the podcast at some point as well. Obviously, a lot of these people, you know, very significant British photographers, and, you know, it's part of my ambition to sort of collect them, as it were, and have them all on the record. Do you have any sort of favourite failures that you can think of, in the sense that failures are a great way to actually learn, you know, that they're a, you know, you can find important lessons in messing things up?
Not really. I mean, you know, there's some projects that are stronger than others, as I said, you know, that's inevitable, but there's always something, even in the things that aren't as good, that makes it worthwhile. So
right.
I don't really don't really subscribe to that.
No.
Particularly.
Well, it doesn't even have to be photographically, it could just be you know, life in general.
Well, no, I'm pretty happy with how it's turned out,
yeah,
to be honest.
Well, that's wonderful to know.
I have to kick myself sometimes, realise I'm still earning a living from my hobby.
Yeah. Oh, well, I had a little quote. Guess who said this? He's an obsessive character who unswervingly follows his instincts. Your wife said that.
Did she?
Yeah.
There you go. Thank
and,
you, Susie.
Yeah, and I'm just thinking, yeah, that's part of the reason for you having achieved what you have, I think. You know, where does that come from, you think, that slightly obsessive?
Well, you know, all photographers or all artists have to be obsessed, really. It's unavoidable. Mm. If they haven't got it, you've got a problem.
Yeah. Well, that's a good tip, I think, because I think that is very true. Are you reasonably optimistic? I mean, despite Brexit and that kind of thing.
Well, when I look at the planet and Brexit, I get very depressed.
Mm.
You know, I mean, you've got these climate deniers like Trump. You know, that's a problem. But yeah, I'm very upbeat in my own personal sort of sense.
Mm.
But you know, the global situation is not good.
No. Have you thought about even exploring climate as a topic, or would that not really be a Martin Parr kind of a climate change, I should say, as a topic?
It has come into my project. I did a project with Oxfam about people in Vietnam being affected by flooding.
Mm.
But no, it's not a big part of what I do. I mean, I'm interested in photographing the leisure pursuits of the Western world.
Right, yes. And so you're very clear on that. That's, you know, that's a sort of...
That's my subject.
Yeah. But what about optimistic in terms of photography's sort of...
Well, yeah, I'm very sort of heartened by the response we've had to the foundation here. I think photography is more popular than ever before. I mean, all these platforms like Instagram have given photography a great boost. And now, of course, we do Instagram as well. And, you know, so let's get more pictures and more photographers.
Mm, mm. Let me ask you a couple of these questions that other people gave me. There was a question about whether there's any particular John Hine postcards that you're after, that you're particularly after to complete your collection.
I think I've got most of them. I mean, the ones I'm most like, of course, are the Butlins, and I've got a file at home, and I think I'm pretty much covered.
Mm.
So yeah, I think all the great Hine postcards have been located. I've been collecting them now for over 30 years.
Yeah, I know. There was a question about sort of, I think it was really about the democratization of, you know, photography, and how there is a tendency for elitism in some respects, that, you know, with documentary and photojournalism, that, you know, it tends to be consumed in a very sort of rarefied atmosphere. But where do you see your yourself in terms of that issue? Because your work is very democratic, I think.
Well, I like the fact that, you know, photography can be high and low culture. I like the fact that you can have it on a museum wall and published, you know, and printed badly in a zine. So I think, you know, that sort of aspect of photography is one of the things that I really admire about it.
Yeah.
It's high and low culture at the same time.
Right, right. Yeah, so you really embrace that rather than
fight it. No, totally. It's one of its great strengths.
Yeah. And you're an avid collector of memorabilia from everywhere. And, you know, is photography also a form of collecting?
Of course, yeah. I mean, I often say that, you know, the collecting of anything from Saddam Hussein watches to space dog ephemera is another form of collecting. Photography is a form of collecting. You have to try and make order of that crazy world out there, and you do so by producing statements about particular aspects of what's going on, and you put them into a show or a book.
Yeah. What are your main preoccupations at the moment in terms of what, you know, what's taking up your time for your own work?
We've just put to bed the book on Manchester. I've got a new book coming out next month on the telephoto pictures that I've taken on the beaches, which is the latest chapter, if you like, on that ongoing exploration. And next year I've got this big show at NPG, so those things are keeping me busy.
Right, National Portrait Gallery, okay. Well, look, we'll look forward to all those things and whatever else comes, because, you know, it's hard to keep up with 100 photo books already, you know, in the can, as it were. But I really appreciate you making the time,
okay,
Martin. It was really important. I see you as the kind of godfather of British photography. I don't know if you... I hope you accept that, you know...
In the spirit in which it's given.
Yeah. And therefore, super... super happy to get you on the podcast. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
It was really nice
talking
to you.